Climate change is the biggest global health threat of the 21st century. They're not my words. That was the bold message from the prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, and University College London just a few years back in a major review and report. And we heard the same message at the recent UN Climate Summit in New York. Didn't get much coverage in Australia, did it? We were seemingly distracted by other things. Globally, though, health agencies are preparing for the impacts that a warming planet is predicted to have on our health, your health, my health. So what impacts are they talking about? And if we reach a situation of adapting to climate change rather than mitigating it, what do we need to be doing? I'm joined by ANU epidemiologist this morning, Liz Hannah. She's president of the Climate and Health Alliance in Australia. That's a coalition of climate and health researchers. Welcome, Liz.
Greetings, hi, and hello to your listeners.
Yes, and we also have on the line Nick Watts, a public health policy specialist. He's project leader of the Lancet Commission. The Commission is a collaboration of UK, Europe, China health researchers, Chinese health researchers investigating the impacts of climate change and the steps needed to mitigate those effects. Welcome, Nick.
Good morning, Natasha. Thanks for having me.
Nick, it's only 5 years since The Lancet produced that really big comprehensive review on health and climate change, and yet you've started another commission to do the very same again this year. Why?
Yeah, that's right. It all started about a year ago, or 2 years ago, when we sat down with some of the people that were involved in the 2009 commission and really had the conversation that everything that had been predicted in 2009 had already started to come to fruition, and it was starting to look like quite a scary world. All of the impacts around the biggest global health threat of the 21st century had started to become a reality. And so this commission really is not so much about the impact, but it's more about defining and identifying the solutions, the ways in which we can protect and promote public health by responding to climate change.
So what things had become a reality that you and colleagues felt were a major concern right now?
Sure. I mean, the effects of climate change on human health go right the way through the whole gamut of health issues you can imagine, from direct impacts, from heat waves and extreme weather events. We've seen Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines or floods in the United Kingdom and Pakistan, through to less direct impacts. We start to see crop failure, and this crop failure leads to either through increased prices or through simply not enough food, malnutrition. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently predicted that the number of undernourished children under the age of 5 in the world is likely to increase up to 25 million by 2050.
The challenge here, though, is connecting this back to climate change, isn't it? And for you, that connection is a vital one.
Yeah, that's right. And I think when we think about sort of making that connection and helping to communicate some of these risks, what we're particularly excited about and focused on is the importance of the health profession and the health professional as an effective messenger of some of these risks and of some of these benefits. In the past, we've seen the health profession take on some of these big fights against entrenched interests, such as big tobacco or big pharma. And they're really experts in understanding and applying the evidence to public health, and have always shown themselves to be willing to stand up for what they believe in, something that protects and promotes human well-being.
How can we be certain, though, about the future impact on health? Are these predictions based on modelling?
Yeah, in part they're based on future modelling, and in part they're based on observed impact. So one of the key features that we're going to see in this Lancet Commission is going to be sort of identifying that really no level of global environmental change or global warming is going to be safe, and they're all going to yield health impacts. And some of those health impacts we've started to see today.
Okay, Liz Hannah, the challenge in this conversation when we talk about global environmental change and global health and the relationship between the two is, of course, making it really personal and real. What is Australian research telling us about the likely health impacts in Australia? We've heard of the environmental impacts like drought, shifting rainfall patterns. What about the health impacts?
Well, these have translated directly to health impacts. Some of the early studies on heat have identified what the threshold temperature is for for spikes in presentations to accident and emergency ambulance call-outs and indeed deaths. So increase in death rates. That's been done in capital cities. What we still don't understand, of course, or it's not so much we don't understand, we're not aware of the human heat threshold and human heat tolerance around Australia. Globally, whereas there's been great advances in protection for floods and storms, so even though there's been greater impact and greater events, there's been improvements through policies and strategies in reducing the number of deaths from floods. But what we've seen in the WMO, the World Meteorological Association report put out, was that there's been a 2,300% increase in global heat deaths. Particularly, this is pumped up by the 2003 heatwave in Europe and the one in Russia. So there were 70,000 deaths in Europe and 55,000 deaths in Australia. This translates to, you know, we're so much hotter. So
are we doing the measuring? Are we looking at heat-related deaths?
Yes, we are. But I mean, it's, you know, counting the deaths, I'm arguing, is all a bit late. What we need to do is identify when people start showing symptoms, and make sure that people are aware of how risky heat exposure can be, because we really are a hot country, and when we get temperatures, you know, getting close to 50, this is really intolerable for people to keep functioning and for society to keep functioning and for people to keep working, and that's the focus of my work.
Well, this is the conversation about adaptation, isn't it? So what sorts of questions are being raised for you around adaptation and extreme heat in cities in Australia or indeed anywhere in Australia?
A lot of it isn't rocket science, but the thing is we can't have a society where it's pretty much like, you know, Dubai, where people live in air conditioning and then, you know, go downstairs to a lift and drive 100 metres to the next building and then go up in that lift. And so mitigation is a really important part of this to avoid going to that. But what we don't know, as I said, is the temperatures where people, and this is locally relevant, temperatures where people need to take more rests, and how we have to have policies throughout workforce. And what's very sad, I mean, you mentioned earlier research and how important that is. The sad news in Australia, it's been probably over 2.5 years now since any research group in Australia received research funding specifically to look at climate change and human health. So we can't continue in this, because it really is a major health threat for Australia.
Has there been a defined cutback on health-related research when it comes to climate change funding?
There was funding through the Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility and through the NHNMRC, but not all that funding for health projects was actually awarded. And it's very depressing, you know, I mean, for our group, of course, at the ANU, but it's the fact that other groups have also not received funding, so their grants have all basically been rejected, all the applications they've put in.
Just thinking about your interest in heat-related deaths because of extreme heat in Australia, what could we do about that that's systematic? Because individually, we all know that we're meant to stay inside on hot days, particularly if we're older, because we're more vulnerable then to dying in extreme heat, but also drink fluids, stay in the shade where we can, stay cool. But what systematically could we do?
One of the main things, I think, is to, you know, for community awareness. And there's also, as far as from the public health spectrum is concerned, when we do have heat extremes, you've got to realise, of course, that there are essential services who are still out there working. You know, the district nurses going around to check on the elderly and the frail and those that have to go up and repair the telephone poles, etc. You know, people looking after stock and zoos, and so there's a lot of essential services where those people continue to be exposed and at risk. So it's a matter of community attitude in recognising that hydration is so important and that resting is really important. So it's a matter of when we can, moving and shifting work, you know, particularly those that involve physical exercise, to the earlier or cooler parts of the day.
Yes, I mean, not rocket science, but interesting thinking about these adaptations in our behaviour. Liz Hanna is with us, president of the Climate and Health Alliance, a coalition of climate and health researchers. And also on Life Matters, Nick Watts, a public health policy specialist, project leader of the Lancet Commission, a big collaboration of health researchers. And they're about to pursue their next major review, looking at the impact of climate change on our health. Nick, I was very interested to see that this year, the British Medical Association, just thinking about this conversation of, health professionals being involved in this conversation, the British Medical Association announced it would no longer invest in fossil fuels. That's a political statement, but what does that actually mean?
Sure. They did do that, and it was quite an exciting moment, because I think what we've seen in the past is that health professionals and their various representative bodies all around the world have made active decisions not to invest their money in things that harm human health. So you see lots of these bodies already screen for tobacco, or they screen for companies that trade or produce arms or alcohol. And so I think really what we saw in the United Kingdom with the British Medical Association was a group of health professionals sitting down and fundamentally thinking about the things that harm health and deciding that fossil fuels and the fossil fuel industry was no longer something that they could justify holding investments with. And this was all around the fact that there are huge health impacts from this industry, both directly in terms of the air pollution and the morbidity and mortality that this brings, but also in terms of its impact on climate change.
But interestingly, the last Lancet Commission report on climate change and health effects acknowledged, well, the health benefits that have come with fossil fuels as well, which is an interesting tension, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And this is sort of part of the complexity is that certainly through process of industrialization there have been large advances in health and human well-being. But I think that those gains are gains that we've had up until now, and what we're going to see throughout the rest of the century, in this century, is that those gains won't materialize as fast, and we're going to need to start to rethink some of those models of how we protect, how we develop. Really, one of the worrying things, in fact, is that as the Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, pointed out to us 2 or 3 weeks ago, if we're not very, very careful, continuing down this path, which has got us as far as it has at the moment, threatens, through climate change, to undermine many of the global health and development advances that we've made over the last few decades. So really there is, despite the fact that there have been those benefits in the past, there is an urgent need to rethink our course.
Thinking about the tension, though, between, for example, meeting the Millennium Development Goals, which are goals that very much target health and well-being, but also economic development. And there is a tension implicit that if people improve their economic well-being, their economic capacity, they in turn improve their health. But in turn, they increase emissions.
Yeah, and this is something that I think we, as a community involved in sustainable development, thought up until recently. The thinking at the moment is that in fact there's not this dichotomy between economic growth and environmentally responsible growth. In fact, if we do it right, they're the same thing. And by implementing policies that both help us respond to climate change in terms of mitigation and in terms of adaptation, we can unlock a whole range of benefits that both improve human health, human well-being, but also help to drive and stimulate the economy. They create new markets, and they unlock, I suppose, new opportunities.
So just briefly, with this commission process that will report back next year with your next major report, what innovative areas of adaptation are you considering?
Sure. I think the one area that, one of the biggest areas that we're looking at the moment is how all of this applies to cities. So there's a mega trend at the moment in the world of urbanization, where we're seeing currently more than half of the world's population live in cities, but by 2050, just over two-thirds of the world's population are predicted to live in urban centres. So this is a huge time of transition. And what we're particularly looking at is how we can make sure that we design some of these cities in a way that helps reduce CO2 emissions, but also creates a more healthy city, and the kind of city where we're able to sort of unlock some of those health benefits for the people that live there. So really, this Lancet Commission, if we said that the headline last time was that climate change is the biggest global health threat of the 21st century, this Lancet Commission is saying, yes, it is the biggest global health threat of the 21st century, but if we're clever about how we run our development and clever about how we redesign our cities, we can turn it from the biggest global health threat into the biggest global health opportunity.
Oh, there's a whole other conversation, how we redesign our cities, and I'd love to have it with you at some stage. Liz Hanna, you attended the recent UN Climate Summit in New York as an Australian epidemiologist. What was that like for you? How big a presence were health professionals and doctors and GPs even?
It was exciting. It was a coming together of, some estimates there are 400,000 people who attended the march on the days before. Very large turnout in terms of health professionals and other concerned groups, and so we were marching with the placards, and also the young medical students with their stethoscopes, and then in subsequent meetings which Nick was at also, and the health summit that Nick played a major part in.
But was there a major disconnect between a country like our own, where our health is very good, compared to countries where they're dealing with fundamental health crises that sort of transcend climate change in some sense as an immediate concern?
Well, it was internationally they seem to be much more advanced than we are naturally in Australia in drawing the link between how serious a threat this is and how it's actually going to affect us in deleterious ways. And so health groups elsewhere are heavily involved, and with the Climate and Health Alliance, we're aligning Australian health professionals and health groups such as the health alliances to vocalise the fact that this is a risk, and we really do need to see what we can do in terms of raising the community awareness and then affecting policies so that we don't continue on this trajectory which is going to cause massive health harm.
Well, look, I thank you both for joining us this morning on Life Matters to just tease out some of the themes that you'll be exploring in the Lancet Commission. Nick Watts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Project leader of the Lancet Commission and a public health policy specialist working globally, but as you can hear, an Australian. And Liz Hanna, president of the Climate and Health Alliance. Thanks so much, Liz.
Cheers, thanks.
And interested in your views on this, get on our Facebook page. Like to hear from you. And our listener feedback line, 02 833 1430.